Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. When your grandmother gets raped, put it on the front page. That was the Medill family editorial policy, and Eleanor Medill Patterson, known to everyone as Sissy, embraced it enthusiastically. As the editor of the Washington Times, she pioneered the 24-hour news cycle, printing 10 editions of the paper per day. Throughout D.C., the Times-Herald was famous as, quote, the damnedest newspaper to ever hit the streets. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Amanda Smith about her latest book, Newspaper Titan, The Infamous Life and Monumental Times of Sissy Patterson. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us for New Books in Biography today. I wonder if you could just kick things off by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born in New York City, and I went to school in New York for the most part to a girls' school called Spence from first grade until I was in high school. And then I went to a boarding school in England called Charterhouse and came back and went to college in the States at Harvard, where I majored in not exactly a dual major, but a department all of its own. Called History and Literature, which has been around for a while, and the premise being that you can't really understand the history of a nation without understanding its literature and vice versa. And then I went back to grad school at Harvard. Having been in history and literature, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to do a PhD in history or in literature, and I ended up choosing the English department at Harvard. And I started out as a Victorianist in the PhD program, but ended up figuring that it was probably going to be easier to get a job as an Americanist. And while I was working, I was all but dissertation. And during my summers in grad school, because I knew a little bit about rare document conservation, my mom had mentioned to me that her father, Joe Kennedy Sr.'s papers, some of them were at the JFK Library, but they hadn't yet been deeded to the National Archives. And the rest, as far as my mom knew, were sort of scattered around at the attic in Hyannisport and the family office in New York City, or at least their office storage. So I started going through the stuff during my summers in grad school and found it really interesting. And just by happenstance, when I had finished my PhD orals, I happened to sit next to a literary agent at a dinner party. And I didn't even know enough to think of selling her a book or anything, but we started talking about doing the preservation work. And she asked me if I would send her some examples of the Joe Kennedy letters, which included a lot of letters back and forth from his kids and from people like Churchill and Roosevelt. And it was a really interesting collection for a lot of reasons, but in part because it had never been opened before, and because insofar as any historians like Doris Kearns Goodwin or Arthur Schlesinger had seen it, they hadn't seen the whole shebang, all the stuff that had come from the attic in Hyannis or from the office in New York and stuff. So I sent her some of the material, and she eventually sold it as a book. And so rather than finish my dissertation, which was going to be about the Massachusetts abolitionist senator, Charles Sumner, he was the one you might remember who was beaten, literally beaten senseless on the floor of the Senate in 1856. He was a really ferocious abolitionist. And anyway, I ended up not doing my dissertation, but instead doing an edition of the letters of Joe Kennedy called Hostage to Fortune. And I find that in my case, I always feel like my projects find me rather than the other way around. And it was through those letters that I found out about Sissy Patterson, who kept coming up. And I mean, she was, in the 30s and 40s, a well-known figure in the United States, and particularly in Washington, where my grandfather was living and working for on and off throughout the 30s in the Roosevelt administration. And then after my mom's family came back from London, where their dad had been stationed as ambassador between 1938 and 1940, one of my mother's elder sisters came back and got a job at the Washington Times Herald, Sissy's newspaper. And so I became really interested in American isolationism between the two world wars. The isolationists were really a colorful bunch, like Lindbergh, or like my grandfather, or William Randolph Hearst, or Colonel McCormick, but of a very colorful, very a big bunch of characters, let's say. Susie Patterson was the most outlandish. And so when I was looking for a new project to do, I just felt like she was sort of beckoning to me from a variety of quarters. And I had heard about her first as a, you know, like a zany lady newspaper publisher in D.C., where I live now. She you know, hadn't really been remembered beyond that. But when I started scratching the surface, I found that she wasn't just any old lady publisher. She actually ran what was by far at the time the most widely circulated daily and the most profitable paper in D.C. And anyway, so that's how I got into this project. But the rest of my own story is that right after I finished the first book, Hostage to Fortune, The Letters of Joe Kennedy, my now husband and I got engaged and I moved to D.C. and we had two kids. And I'd been thinking about writing the Sissy book for a while, but people always ask me how long it took me to put it together. And I always think back and time it by the birth of my younger child, my son, who's going to be 7 in March. And I sent in the proposal, and my agent called me back and said that Knopf was interested in it, but could I do it in 2 years? And I said, well, my husband and I are thinking of having a second child in the meantime, so I'm not sure I could do it in 2 years, actually. And so we negotiated the time schedule and stuff, and I think we sold it on a Monday, and on Friday I found out I was pregnant with my son. So I always think, you know, he and the Sissy book are just about the same age in a way. And once I had kids, I wasn't quite as efficient as I used to be. But it was a really fascinating process, and one that I'm really glad that I did.
The thing that really struck me about Newspaper Titan is that it's a really smooth and enjoyable read, and yet it's also the sprawling story that incorporates a massive amount of research. You have nearly 100 pages of endnotes. And can you talk a bit about the sources that you uncovered as you were going along?
Well, I always find that, you know, in as much as I feel like the project always finds me, but that the sources are almost like one of the things I love most about doing historical research is that in a lot of ways it's like assembling some sort of mosaic. And, you know, you don't know the whole story until you have all of, or at least I never feel like I can write unless I have all of my ducks in a row and all of the documents that I'm likely to find for the most part. You know, every so often something else will, you know, come out of the blue. But so I like to collect everything first and then put it into chronological order and then read it all over in chronological order, because you don't always find it in chronological order. And then once you read it in the order in which it was written, it makes so much more sense and you see all sorts of insights and parallels, and you see the unfolding of events in a way that you couldn't otherwise. And so some of the sources, I started out by, you know, as anybody would, trying to contact any members of Sissy's family who were still alive. And at the time, her granddaughter, Ellen, was still alive and living in San Diego. And Ellen was a really interesting character. And, you know, it's hard to tell when you meet somebody like that, if you're projecting, let's say, in her case, her grandmother's character onto her, you know, very quixotic, very charming, and sometimes very malevolent figure onto, you know, poor unsuspecting Ellen. But I think they did have certain characteristics in common. They were both very intelligent, very witty. Sometimes Ellen could be pretty tart. And I spent a fair amount of time with her. And one thing that was very poignant to me was that I was pregnant with my son, as I was saying, when I first started doing the research, when I first went out to visit Ellen in San Diego. And she would have been in her 80s then. But it was also the first time that I ever left my daughter, my elder child, who at the time was 3. And over the course of doing research, I found the memoirs that Sissy's daughter, Felicia, left. And Felicia was a child of, you know, great privilege and great wealth, but somebody who, for all the luxury in her life, or early life at least, had a very difficult childhood. I mean, I can't think of many other examples that were quite that dramatic. She was the child who, you know, just for the sake of the reader, was basically kidnapped by her father after her parents' marriage fell apart in a really violent way. And she was held for a year and a half. It's not even entirely clear where she was exactly. But she left, anyway, the Tsar of Russia, Nicholas II, and President Taft had to intervene to retrieve her. And she finally came home, and even though Sissy had tried really hard to get her back, for whatever reason, I think in part because Sissy's own mother wasn't a very hands-on caregiver, that Sissy wasn't a very maternal type and didn't really nurture Felicia once she got her home. And Felicia herself grew up to have a very interesting life, but a difficult one. And her memoir that she wrote at the end of her life in her 80s, partly in rebuttal to an earlier biography of Sissy, was one that was really crucial to my research, but which was very poignant to me to read because she was a child who was kidnapped at the age of 2 1/2 and was held basically until she was 4. And in the meantime, in order for me to read this material and find out about Felicia, I had to leave my own little daughter at home. And, you know, the two situations obviously weren't quite the same. It wasn't like a kidnapping and just, you know, leaving your child behind at home with her dad and, you know, with a babysitter and safe and going to school and everything isn't the same thing, but it was the first time I'd ever left her behind, and it made me think a lot about Felicia's childhood. Mm-hmm. So Felicia's papers were really crucial and very poignant, and she ended up growing up to be one of the first women to join AA in the 1940s. And until I started doing research on this book, I didn't even know that AA went back that far. And so there were a lot of kind of sidelines that became really fascinating, like the history of AA and Felicia's first marriage to a guy who ended up becoming a really famous political columnist called Drew Pearson. And Drew Pearson's early life was really fascinating, too. And all of this, you know, is intertwined with the history and growth of the tabloid in the United States and the growth of tabloid culture and the golden age of the newspaper. And I think probably the most amazing cache of documents that I found was the part about Felicia's kidnapping. And I couldn't figure out what had happened during the 18 months that she had been taken by her father from her mother. And all of the newspaper stories in the United States seemed to be kind of, well, mutually contradictory. I couldn't figure out, you know, how they'd gotten her back or what had happened or who exactly did what. Or and the basic background is, I don't know if you want me to fill that in.
Yeah, go ahead.
But the basic background was that Sissy married a Polish count called Józef Giżyszki in 1904 against her parents' wishes. And her father, in an effort to scare Giżyszki away, refused to give Sissy a dowry, which was the customary thing at the time. And Sissy, being nothing if not fashionable, wanted to do the fashionable thing and marry a title. She was an American heiress. And so her early life really was like something out of Edith Wharton and Henry James. And I'm not convinced that Edith Wharton didn't in part base the character of Countess Ellen Olenska and Countess Eleanor Gajishka in The Age of Innocence. But in any case, so Sissy got married and very quickly discovered that her husband was even more of a cad than she had been warned he would be. and left him after 4 years of marriage, still bleeding from the beating that he had dealt her that night. And she fled to London, basically, where her father had been traveling on business with her then 2.5-year-old daughter, Felicia. Sissy started to blame herself for the rupture in the marriage pretty shortly after that and tried to make it up with the Count. They met in Paris. He managed to sweet-talk her into giving up the little girl's address. At the time, she was being hidden outside of London with her nanny. And the Count, after beating up Sissy again and threatening to kill her, left, went to London, picked up the child, and had told Sissy that he would come back and they would, you know, all be a family again. But he never came back and basically held the little girl in an effort to squeeze more money out of Sissy's family because he'd never gotten a dowry to begin with. And finally, because Sissy's family was very well connected, her grandfather, Joseph Medill, was a very famous abolitionist and was one of the sort of founding fathers of the Republican Party before the Civil War. And the family was able to ask President Taft to intervene. And because some of her relatives had lived in Russia, her uncle was the American ambassador in the early part of the, in the first years of the 20th century in St. Petersburg, they were able to get the Tsar, Nicholas II, to intervene to get the little girl back. And so I was trying to figure out exactly what did happen because the press accounts only show that Felicia was taken and there was a big custody battle. And then nearly 2 years later, she comes back, but it's not clear what happened in the meantime. So what I did was reading the press accounts, I found that there was a character called Baron Budberg in St. Petersburg who was a member of the, you know, at the time very quite extensive late Imperial Russian civil service. And he was in charge of something. Somehow he was said to have been of use to Sissy's family in getting the little girl back, but I wasn't sure if that was in a private capacity or whether, you know, he had done something official to help her. And none of the newspapers really clarified what, you know, what role he had played. So I started, trying to grasp at straws. I tried to figure out who this Budberg fellow was. And it turned out that he was in charge of this sort of governmental body called the Chancellery for Receipt of Petitions. And when I started looking into what that was, it turned out it was this body which was instituted to enforce what was called the Tsar's supreme will. Church religious law and the Orthodox Church at the time didn't permit couples to divorce, but the Tsar had the right to make individual decrees of divorce in cases where women or children might be in danger, or where there was, you know, really irreconcilable differences between a couple or within a couple. And, you know, if somebody was in danger, the Tsar could intervene to dissolve a marriage. And so finally it made sense to me that Baron Budberg would have had something to do with returning Felicia. So I started doing a little more research about the chancellery and found out that there's a fair amount of new American scholarly interest in late Imperial Russian legal matters, and particularly in this body, the Chancellery, and, you know, through its papers, which have survived in large part, there have been all sorts of new examinations of late Russian imperial families. And so there's a professor at Boulder who had written quite extensively about the Chancellery and about some of their cases. So I got in touch with her and said, you know, explained what I was doing and, you know, said, I see that you quote from a lot of these cases. Is it possible that the case, the Gajishki case file, would still exist? And she happened to have a list of all the documents from a particular archive containing the Chancellery's records that had been culled. All the materials that had been culled for families whose name began with G. And she said, you know, your family's name isn't on that, which means that it could still exist, but that archive is closed and, you know, won't be open for indefinitely. We don't know when it'll open again. So I got sort of discouraged at that. But then I thought, well, I don't know, I'll see if I can figure out more about it. So I looked up whether I could find maybe a research assistant or something in St. Petersburg to look into it, because I don't speak Russian. And, you know, like I said, I have two small kids, and I didn't think I'd be able to go to St. Petersburg myself. And it turns out that, lo and behold, there is an entire business that I guess people usually use for genealogical research in Russia, but that they have a special relationship with this particular archive that was closed, and can actually get access to materials there. So they found the file. And once I got the file, obviously in Russian partly, but it was also in German and English and French. And so once the German and Russian parts were translated, and again, once I put all the material back into chronological order, what had happened to Felicia was clear. All of the ins and outs, all of the negotiations, how they fell through, how they were renewed again, the ultimate settlement, and the correspondence from all of the major figures, from Sissy, from Gajishki, from Sissy's mother, from her father. And all of a sudden, the whole thing became clear. And so sometimes I find it's, I love the detective work of it. And sometimes if you just, you know, you're at the end of your rope and you can't figure out where the documents might be or whether they still exist, if you go out on a tangent and look into, you know, whatever few facts you do know about a situation, sometimes they turn up a real treasure trove of material. And so that was the case with the Russian material about Felicia. And then, there were so many great archives, and it's such a, you know, you get so many windows onto people's lives. Like, I really enjoyed doing research in the Drew Pearson papers. He was Sissy's daughter, Felicia, the one who kidnapped her first husband. And he had a really meteoric career in his own right. He was basically the first, sort of invented with a colleague, the political gossip column, and became, after Walter Winchell, by the 1930s and 40s, he was the second most highly paid, after Winchell, columnist in the United States. He had a radio show. He was, really well known, really influential. And to see the, you know, read his papers and see the development of his own career was also a really interesting lens through which to see the growth of the tabloid and the growth of the syndicated column and the effects on national public opinion and the way that columns like that played out in elections or in changing American public opinion about intervention into the Second World War. It was really fascinating. And so I think that doing the research is, you know, probably one of my favorite parts of doing a book like this.
So fascinating. I wonder if you could, you mentioned Sissy's malevolence. If you could just talk about, that's a very important word, I think, in the book. If you could just talk a bit about her personality, not necessarily her family connections, which we'll get to in a second, but just who she was herself on her own.
Well, Sissy was somebody who I've always thought was really highly intelligent and who didn't really have an outlet for all of her abilities for much of her life. I also suspect, although it's a pet peeve of mine when writers or historians make, you know, what are in effect psychiatric or medical diagnoses, because we're not qualified to do that. And even if we were, it would be pretty cheap to, you know, make a psychiatric diagnosis of somebody we've never met and will never meet. But there's anecdotal evidence within Sissy's family to suggest that they, you know, were, if nothing else, given to instability and to alcoholism. And a granddaughter of one of Sissy's cousins has suggested in her own scholarly work that there was a certain degree of bipolar disorder in the family. And whether that applied to Sissy or not, I'm not sure, but I think it's pretty clear that she had a propensity for alcoholism, and that later in her life, there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that she was using intravenous stimulants, probably cocaine, that she received from a sort of white Russian immigre quack doctor who was practicing in Washington at the time. So I think she was very brilliant. She was at times, as you said, really malevolent. And the form that would take was she was, I don't know, I love the fact that she was often described by contemporaries as being very feline. She was apparently memorably graceful, and I'm not really sure what that means, but anyway, that's what everybody said about her. She was like a panther or something like that. She moved, you know, like water, essentially. She was also like a cat in being, you know, very, she took good care of herself. She was always beautifully dressed, beautifully done up. And she was also a very catty woman. And the thing on top of it was that she always struck me as somebody who almost had nine lives. You know, she was an heiress when she was young. She was a countess. She was splashed through the international headlines as a notorious divorcee who was part of a notorious international custody battle. Then she came home and she was an actress for a while. She was a novelist. But the thing she really wanted to do was get into the family business. And her family owned or the majority stake in the Chicago Tribune. And she didn't really have any way of writing for the Tribune or participating in the management of it. And so she began writing stories here and there for the most part for the Hearst Press. And Hearst was pretty much her own family's sworn enemy. And Hearst, I think, in an effort as much to irritate her brother at the New York Daily News and her cousin, Colonel McCormick, at the Chicago Tribune, hired her to edit his losing Washington, D.C. Herald in 1930. And Sissy took it up both because she had, I think it's fair to say, she had whatever strange genius or alchemy or ability one needs to run and maintain and improve a tabloid newspaper. But also, I think Hearst, you know, gave her the chance to use her talents and to, you know, indulge this desire she'd had for a long time to go into newspapers. But also, I think he always knew the value of a publicity stunt, and having a woman edit and daily newspaper was, you know, at the time there weren't any women doing it, and there hadn't been for so long, basically since the late 19th century, that a lot of accounts about Sissy's becoming editor of the Herald described her as the first in American history. She wasn't, but she was the first to have any long tenure over, you know, say a few years. And for whatever reason, she had no particular education at all, and she certainly had very little journalistic experience, but for whatever reason, she was able to make a go of the Washington Herald, and she made it the leader in the Washington morning market within 3 years. By the end of the decade, she bought not only the Herald from Hearst, who was by then going bankrupt, but his evening paper in D.C., The Times. She combined them at personal expense, and she was also, I should say, the only person in the United States to actually own outright a major metropolitan daily newspaper. She just bought the paper herself. But her combined paper, the Washington Times Herald, was the most widely circulated by far throughout the 1940s, despite it being very ferociously anti-Roosevelt and anti-war, even after the United States got into the war. And I have to say, like, whatever strange magic she had, it's, when you read the Times Herald now, there's the only complete set that I know of microfilms is down at the MLK Library in D.C. And I used to really enjoy going down there every day to read the Times Herald because it is really fun. It's really malevolent. It's really gossipy. And you can't believe that she was able to put some of this down on paper. And it's true, like, when you actually look at the legal records, in D.C. at the National Archives of Newspapers in the mid-century. Her Times Herald, and before that her Herald and her Times, were more often sued for libel than any other publications in D.C. And when you look at libel law now, there's still cases that come up and that serve as case law that, you know, derive from Sissy's tenure at the Times or the Herald or the Times Herald. And she would often pay libel judgments out of her own pocket, which basically gave her free rein to say whatever she wanted about anybody. And that's what she did. She reserved for herself a front page box whenever she felt like it in her newspaper. And as often as not, she would use it to make an ad hominem attack on somebody. She began by doing that against her old frenemy, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, who was a sort of girlhood friend of hers, but somebody who I suspect she was both in awe of and a little bit jealous of. And anyway, so Sissy attacked her as one of her first acts as editor of the Herald in 1930. And the effect of it was to make the paper, sales of the paper jumped really dramatically. And so Sissy was sort of emboldened by that and went on in that vein. And I was actually at a giving a talk yesterday, and somebody was covering it from New York Social Diary, and she was saying to me, like, you know, I'm so interested in being here because Sissy was kind of the progenitor of the New York Social Diary type of journalism, like the overlap between, you know, covering the overlap between gossip and parties and politics, which is, you know, very much what goes on in D.C. and did at the time. I suppose it's gone on in D.C. since the city's inception. But Sissy really captured that and captured that nexus of, you know, gossip, politics, intrigue, policy, secrets, strategic planning. And she, I think that's kind of the genius of her paper, is that it's fun to read. You can also tease out, you know, secrets or hints that she gives about anything from people's sex lives to, you know, secret plans that she knows about that, you know, are going to be revealed, secret military plans or secret political plans or, anyway, it's a fascinating newspaper to read. And some people have sort of pawned it off as silly, but I think it's actually very sophisticated. And I think her, you know, I have to say, like, her brand of malice makes it a fun read. And although D.C., you know, after the war, after Pearl Harbor, the entire country really got behind the president and behind the war effort. But Sissy's paper, you know, remained very anti-Roosevelt, very hostile to the war effort. And even so, it, if anything, its sales rose. And I think it's being such a fun kind of guilty pleasure is what accounts for that. And I think that, you know, any newspaper proprietor, particularly at the time, really put their mark on their own publication. And Colonel McCormick's Chicago Tribune was very much a kind of mouthpiece of McCormick and his way of thinking. In New York, Joe Patterson's Sissy's Brothers, New York Daily News, the first Bible tabloid in the United States, was very much a kind of embodiment of Joe Patterson himself. And I think Sissy's Washington Times Herald was very much like Sissy. I mean, it was very tart, very funny, very fickle, very unreasonable at times, libelous, mean-spirited, but also at times very charitable and did really great, important work. Like, it started a drive to create a school lunch program that eventually became federally funded and became, you know, one of the models for school lunches across the country. And all of that was Sissy's idea. So she was a really contradictory person who, you know, I'm sure it was difficult to be friends with, and very few people were able to remain friends with her. But I think her paper, if you could stand back and read her paper and not get too close to her, you know, it was really fun. It was a really exciting read.
You mentioned the three papers of the family. One of the things that I thought was really interesting was once they, on the advent of World War II, how they came out very strongly isolationist and kind of used all three papers in tandem together. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, Franklin Roosevelt and many members of the administration and the press at the time began describing the family in the early 1940s as the Patterson-McCormick axis. Henry Luce described them as the three furies of the isolationist press. And those descriptions weren't exaggerations. I mean, they hounded Roosevelt, essentially. And it was all the more dramatic, I think, because basically the Pattersons and their cousin Colonel McCormick had grown up with Franklin Roosevelt. The two boys had gone to school with him at Groton. And Joe Patterson began his life as, although you know, he was a newspaper heir and went to a fancy New England boarding school and, you know, was, lived in great comfort and luxury, even was actually a card-carrying socialist, and throughout his life was famous for having a very genuine kind of common touch and a sort of fascination with the common man. I mean, there are stories of him growing up in Chicago and wandering down alleyways to look at, you know, just how ordinary people live. And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't patronizing, he wasn't condescending. He didn't go as a sort of anthropologist. He went because he really admired people who did hard work. And his paper really reflected that. So, you know, the New York Daily News was very celebratory of, and, you know, very proletarian in its base. It was a copy, essentially, of, or it was closely modeled after Britain's Daily Mail. In the, you know, it was, the stories were made sort of much shorter, much punchier, much, you know, at the Daily News, the use of polysyllables was discouraged. The paper was packed with, you know, the latest technology in terms of putting photographs into the paper, you know, bigger headlines, punchier writing style, contests, giveaways. And the other thing that Joe Patterson had a great love for and kind of genius for was the creation of comic strips. And he actually was the progenitor and the, you know, developer, the author, the original author of a lot of comic strips that we remember even today, like Little Orphan Annie or Dick Tracy, Moon Mullins. There are, you know, a number that would be less well known now, but that were incredibly popular in the mid-century and continued on after his death in 1946. And the three, Sissy, Joe, and Rob McCormick, Colonel McCormick, were sort of at odds, at least philosophically or politically, say, by the beginning of the 1930s. Colonel McCormick, who reportedly had always hated Franklin Roosevelt at Groton, and vice versa, Roosevelt had always hated him.
Well, McCormick was consistently hostile to Roosevelt and to the administration and its aims and objectives. Joe Patterson was, as usual, the opposite, at least at the beginning of the administration. He made, or his Daily News at least, made a pledge that I'm not sure had any precedence, and I don't think has ever been repeated, where the day after Roosevelt's inaugural in 1933, Joe Patterson's Daily News pledged not to make, given the, you know, the enormity of the national, you know, the Depression, essentially. Joe Patterson pledged not to criticize Roosevelt in print or the administration in print for a year because of the unusual difficulties that the administration faced. And at the end of that year, in 1934, the Daily News pledged to extend that sort of embargo on criticism for another year. And at one point, it was said that Roosevelt was prepared to offer Joe Patterson a cabinet post, which he wouldn't have taken, but they were, you know, not only on friendly terms. They didn't just see eye to eye philosophically. I mean, Joe Patterson was a great admirer of the New Deal, especially the socialistic aspects of it. And, you know, the efforts to create jobs, to create, you know, infrastructure and, you know, jobs for artists. And anyway, he was very supportive of Roosevelt. But where intervention was concerned, that's where the, you know, he drew the line. And Sissy tended to follow her brother ideologically in most things. She wasn't an extreme socialist, but she was, you know, more to the left of the scale early on in her life. And she was more skeptical of the Roosevelt administration, especially by the Second New Deal. And Joe Patterson's experience when war finally came, Joe Patterson went to Roosevelt's office, made an appointment to see him on December 11th, 1941, and got into his World War I uniform. And he was a very highly regarded World War I soldier. He was decorated. He had been gassed in the trenches. He was beloved by his men. And he was sort of legendary, actually, Captain Patterson. And he went and he offered his services to Roosevelt, saying, you know, I disagreed with you about whether or not we should get into the war, but now that the Japanese have attacked us, I want to lend all of my support to my country. And according to Joe Patterson's account of the meeting, Roosevelt was sitting at his desk when Joe Patterson came in. Patterson saluted Roosevelt as the commander-in-chief. Roosevelt sort of glanced up at him and said, just a minute, and kept signing the documents that he was working on for, according to Joe Patterson, 15 minutes, while Joe Patterson stood at attention in front of his desk. Then finally Roosevelt looked up and, according to Joe Patterson again, only shook Patterson's hand because Patterson offered it, and then sort of lit into Patterson saying, you want to offer your services? Well, this is what you can do. You can go home and you can read all of the editorials that the Post published, the New York Daily News published in the last year, and consider the damage to the cause, as he put it. And that's what you can do for me. And Joe Patterson was so angry that he was staying at Sissy's house in Washington at that point and came home and said, you know, that man lied to the American public. He was aiming to get us into that war while claiming publicly that no American boys were going to die abroad. And now all I want to do is outlive that bastard. And at that point, Sissy was always happy to carry out a grudge. And she was so disgusted by the ill treatment her brother had received that she and her brother and Colonel McCormick at the Tribune began acting effectively in concert against the administration. And, you know, looking back, that seems sort of Lilliputian, but, you know, if you think of it, the Chicago Tribune had by far the widest circulation in the Midwest. The New York Daily News still holds records for circulation, had the widest Sunday circulation in the world, the largest daily circulation in the United States. And then Sissy's paper, the Washington Times-Herald, had by far the widest circulation in D.C., meaning that, you know, probably all of the elected officials in Washington, all the diplomats, all the cabinet secretaries, all their staff, you know, all the diplomatic corps, the press corps, all read her paper. And so it had, you know, maybe a disproportionate reach given how small a city Washington is. But in any case, those three papers together were had considerable influence. And there are letters actually from Roosevelt to Churchill complaining about the Patterson-McCormick people, as he put it, and saying, you know, that he could only pity Bertie and Sissy and Joe because they'd always been nuts. And but you can tell that Roosevelt always made such an effort to present an unruffled facade, but, you know, I think that they really galled him. And so, yeah, I mean, I think Sissy's cattiness and her love of holding a grudge really played out during the war. And I think it was also played out because there was, you know, not only the fact that her family had known Franklin Roosevelt growing up, but there was also the issue of Drew Pearson, who her ex-son-in-law, who had by then become a very prominent political columnist and who was unabashedly pro-Roosevelt. Even though Roosevelt himself often called Pearson a liar at press conferences and things, Pearson was a very staunch liberal, very supportive of the New Deal, and unwaveringly supportive of intervention into the Second World War. And Sissy had basically become estranged from her daughter, Felicia, the little girl who had been kidnapped by the mid-1930s. But strangely enough, although Felicia had divorced Drew Pearson, Sissy was very close to him and to her granddaughter, Ellen, who lived for much of her life with Drew Pearson, and with Drew Pearson's second wife, Lou V. Moore Abel Pearson. And when Drew Pearson began writing very pro-interventionist columns in the late 1930s and early 1940s, Sissy began cutting the column and putting it, as she herself put it, further and further back in her newspaper towards the patent medicine ads. And so eventually Drew Pearson's agent gave notice that the the Times Herald would no longer be publishing the Washington merry-go-round in D.C. And then, you know, all hell broke loose at that point, and Sissy was really vicious. And so her anti-war, anti-interventionist sentiment really played itself out personally and publicly. And in addition to attacking the war effort, she also attacked anybody who espoused it, Drew Pearson in particular, but also Franklin Roosevelt and the dealers, even, you know, young servicemen and women, which was obviously not only wrong-headed, but very unpopular. And she began receiving death threats, and a bomb was lobbed through the front door of the Times Herald building. And Sissy, who at this point had begun to see the white Russian immigrant doctor for shots of various sorts, became really erratic. And you can see it in the Times Herald as well. That, I mean, she made editorial decisions that I don't think had ever been seen before or since, you know, attacking Drew Pearson personally and making, she put a picture of Drew Pearson next to a picture of Robespierre, and, you know, sort of comparing what she described as liberal excesses in the French Revolution compared to the liberal excesses of the modern day, the New Deal, and, you know, the interventionist set. And said really vicious things about him, which tended to boost his popularity and make her angrier and angrier. But, you know, the drama and the vituperation and the bile that she shared really displayed itself publicly in the Times Herald. And I think that's another example of how much a reflection of her personality the paper was.
That same cattiness kind of came out in her will, too, didn't it?
She was somebody who, you know, had acted on her whims. And over the course of doing research, I found literally dozens of wills that she made and remade over the course of her adult life. And it was interesting to, you know, read them all in sequence and see, you know, basically you could chart who she was angry at and what, you know, effect that had in her, you know, her goodwill towards them in terms of, like, what she intended to leave to people. And the person who really suffered most from these changes was her granddaughter, Ellen, who, when Sissy made what was believed to be her last will, the one that was finally probated, Ellen was 16, and Felicia had lost custody of her because of drinking. So Ellen was living with her dad, and his second wife, living with Drew Pearson and his second wife in Georgetown. And when Ellen was a little girl, Sissy had been sort of extravagantly fond of her by all accounts. And for a 10th birthday present, she gave Ellen a 280-acre dairy farm just north of D.C. in Potomac, Maryland. And Drew Pearson became the trustee for it and started a working dairy operation there and maintained it and put up structures and basically treated it like a country house and paid Ellen sort of a rent, which Sissy later claimed was not the market rent and that Drew Pearson had been taking advantage of his daughter. Sissy brought suit against Drew Pearson repeatedly in the early 1940s in the sort of ancillary effort to attack him while she was attacking him in the pages of her newspaper. And although she claimed that she was bringing suit against Drew Pearson for mismanagement of the farm and of Ellen's assets, it seemed that that wasn't her real motivation because Ellen herself, at the age of 16, was named as a co-defendant in Sissy's suit. And finally, Sissy felt that Ellen had chosen her father, Drew Pearson, over Sissy herself. And, you know, that's an unfair position to put any teenager in, especially when, you know, Ellen hadn't reached the age of majority yet and was living under her father's roof. Sissy seemed to expect her to choose Sissy. And so Sissy wrote her a very venomous letter at one point saying, you know, that necklace I gave you last year, well, I guess, you know, it looks like you lost it. And too bad for you because that's the last thing you're ever going to get out of me. And then she changed her will and wrote Ellen out of it. And my husband, who is a lawyer and does a lot of trust and estates work, said that the only will he's ever seen, you know, if somebody's written out of a will, typically they're just not mentioned in it later. But he said this is the only will he's ever seen where somebody was specifically written out of the will. Sissy included language saying, because I've given Ellen significant gifts during my lifetime, I choose not to make any provision for her now. Which, you know, and imagine doing that to a 16-year-old girl. So by the end of the war, Sissy had really burnt her bridges and was very lonely, increasingly erratic. Her newspaper reflected that, and, you know, her closest friends, people said at that point, became her unruly poodles. So I picture the scene in her houses, of which there were several very grand places. You know, Sissy and her ferocious poodles, a lot of people describe them as a pack. And I think they must have been, like, thing one, thing two, and several more, because they, you know, they're described as biting people whenever they felt like it without reprimand, and they would steal the toilet paper from the bathrooms and sort of festoon the house with paper, and, you know, people would have to step over these, like, chewed upon shoes and bits of toilet paper and furniture, and so, you know, I think it was sort of chaos at Sissy's house, and it's not so much at the paper, because that was run by other people, but the editorial decisions, I think, reflect her state of mind.
What do you see as her legacy?
I think that one thing that makes me very sad about her is that I think often about a quotation that I read from a woman journalist who was a contemporary of Sissy's who didn't work for the Washington Times Herald, but you know, certainly was aware of Sissy as a woman journalist in Washington in the 1940s. And she said that the real shame was that Sissy could have made such a spectacular, lasting contribution to women in journalism, but didn't. And I think that that's very sad, and I think that, you know, I think it would pain Sissy to hear that. But in fairness to Sissy, well, I think she missed... I think the woman was right that, you know, Sissy missed a real opportunity. I think it's worth remembering that some of the things that we take for granted about journalism today, Sissy actually put in place almost single-handedly. She's seldom credited with it, but basically she single-handedly brought the 24-hour news cycle to Washington, D.C. Her paper, when she merged the Times and the Herald, they became the first round-the-clock paper in D.C., and that model was... copied, you know, essentially everywhere afterwards. Sissy was also one of the first editor, the first editor, basically, to hire women in large numbers for her city room, and to employ them not as secretaries or as, you know, stenographers or whatever, but as actual reporters and editors. And so the Times Herald actually suffered a lot fewer manpower shortages when World War II finally did come, because they were already pretty well staffed with women. And I think that, you know, she had many legacies that we take for granted now and that we don't necessarily ascribe to her. But I think she was a real pioneer. And another thing about her that I find really admirable was, you know, I think of how many women have been bowled over by a terrible marriage and how difficult it is for people to pick up and start a new life afterwards. And I think for somebody who was abused physically and emotionally extensively for several years by a husband who, you know, was certainly an alcoholic and probably mentally ill, who kidnapped her child and humiliated her internationally and, you know, stole money from her. I think to pick yourself up after that and make not one successful career for yourself, but several careers for yourself is a great lesson for anybody. And so, you know, I think there's sometimes Sissy was hard to like when I was writing about her, but I think that you know, that ultimate kind of pick herself up and go on pluck is a great thing to, for me, I find, to remember that, you know, people can go through terrible things and keep on going and, you know, make good afterwards, which I think is great.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about Newspaper Titan. I know it's a cruel question to ask an author whose book only just came out, but do you have any idea who you'll be writing about next?
Well, I have some ideas actually about Drew Pearson. Oh. And I think maybe not immediately, but at some point I would love to write about Joe Patterson. Mm-hmm. I think he's often credited or maybe faulted for bringing the tabloid to the United States and, you know, tabloidizing American culture insofar as he's remembered at all. But I think he had a really strange sort of P.T. Barnum-like genius in, you know, newspaper editor form. And I think he totally changed American culture in a way that we don't even recognize nowadays, you know, for better or worse. But I think he was a really, really important, really influential figure in American history who was actually very self-effacing, and so I think that's part of the reason that we don't remember him. So those are, off the top of my head, those are my ideas, but again, like, I always find, you know, something will draw me in and I'll find myself writing all of a sudden, you know, the topic will find me. But in the meantime, I still have a few talks and interviews and stuff like that about Newspaper Titan. So I'm going to finish those and then take a couple weeks off and sit down and figure out what to do next.
I think you've earned a bit of a break.
Oh, thanks. No, she was really fun to write about.
I've been speaking with biographer Amanda Smith about her latest book, Newspaper Titan, The Infamous Life and Monumental Times of Sissy Patterson, which is now out in hardback. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.